Hello again, I'm Ed Mullins. Welcome back to To The Point. With me today is Bob Mladenovich, retired NYPD detective and psychologist, and both prosecutor and criminal defense attorney Glenn Abalafia, Bronx native, who began his career early on in the district attorney's office in Queens. I want to welcome both of you. Glenn, first time I'm meeting you, but welcome aboard. Bob, you and I work together all the time. So, good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
How are you?
Thank you for having me.
Well, happy you were able to make it. I think that today we should be able to shed some light to the general public. You were actually on both sides of the fence as far as being a prosecutor and criminal defense. High-profile cases. We follow them in a newspaper all the time. Everyone has an opinion. One of the biggest cases that I'm aware of, unless there's one that's been hiding, is the Joel Rifkin case. So you represented Joel Rifkin, if I'm correct. What is that like to have such a high profile case of, and in this case, we have a serial killer. You're on the other side of the coin as a prosecutor, and now you're the defense to Joel Rifkin.
Well, the way you approach it is that the outside world defines whether or not it's a high profile case. You approach the case, it's your little narrow world, and you try to keep it narrow and a closed world, but it's the outside that starts to define the what's considered high profile. And you know, what grabs media attention, what sells the newspapers, connects with the press, they have a different motivation and different view of this. So being a prosecutor, you're on call, you get a call to a crime scene, and the work has to start. The same with the defense attorney. When the client walks into the office, you're not worried about whether or not it's a high profile case. You have to deal with the problem in front of you. And so the work begins. It's an added pressure, however, obviously. But you never know ahead of time whether a case is going to be a high-profile case.
Yeah, just a quick correction, Ed. Glenn was a prosecutor in the Queens DA's office and worked on the prosecution of Joel Rifkin.
Oh, I had it backward. My apologies.
Yeah, yeah. And he's been a defense attorney since 1993.
That's correct.
So the prosecution of Joel Rifkin, which we'll get into in a minute. I mean, you're working as a prosecutor. You've handled many homicides, I'm sure.
Not as a prosecutor. I was in homicide investigations as a prosecutor. It was as a defense attorney handling homicide cases. Trial work.
Taking cases to trial on the homicides.
On the homicides.
You know, many of the TV shows are all based on criminal investigations and homicides. And, you know, we put a segment together in an hour telling a story of a whole homicide to what actually transpires from the day someone becomes a homicide victim right up until the end of a prosecution, possibly an appeal. There's a tremendous amount of work that goes into it. And I'm, going to say from handling is a lot of emotional impact that homicides take a toll on you. So as the defense attorney in homicides, I mean, you're kind of, I'm going to say the words conflicted, although I do understand that everyone's entitled to representation, but here you are, you have someone who's committed a murder or charged with committing a murder, and your job is to give them justice, put them through the justice system. Have there been times where you felt like this person is guilty, but I still need to do my job and take them through this?
Right. Bottom line is that, the process starts as a defense attorney where the charge, as we say, it's simply an accusation. The prosecution has the burden of proof. They have to prove the case. And what may seem obvious sometimes isn't. And so the investigation from the defense side begins. Many cases, like currently, are forensic based, DNA, video, cell phone. So you wanna make sure that the people, the prosecution, can prove their case. So, you may have a confession, but in and of itself, the confession is not going to prohibit me from doing my work and holding the prosecution to their proof, and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. You hear that phrase all the time. That's the standard. But I have an ethical obligation to put aside any personal feelings or anything I may learn to hold the prosecution to their proof. For example, here in a shooting where there's a self-defense claim, you know that a shooting happened, but then there's another side to it. So if there's a legitimate self-defense claim, you want to bring that out. That's going to be a complete defense to, let's say, a charge of murder where self-defense is an issue and can be proven. Well, we don't have a burden of proof, but it becomes an issue for a jury to decide.
Glenn, can you just expound on the fact that as a defense attorney, you don't really have to prove that somebody's innocent. You just have to create a reasonable doubt.
Right. The defense in any criminal prosecution, no matter where the jurisdiction is, does not have any burden of proof whatsoever, which means we don't have to prove someone is innocent. We don't have a burden of proof. There's certain types of cases where there may be a slight burden of proof, such as a psychiatric defense case, where we have an affirmative obligation, an obligation to present evidence that someone committed a crime, but was not aware of could not distinguish between right and wrong to establish a psychiatric defense. So yes, the defense does not have a burden of proof. It's the prosecution that has to prove whether or not the crime occurred, and that's their burden. And it's the most important principle in the criminal justice system. It's counterintuitive in many ways, because the first question someone asks, well, you know, if he's innocent, they would say he didn't do it. And sometimes they do say they didn't do it, but that's not really the issue. The issue is, can the state prove the case?
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, that being the issue, it's really a matter of law. It's a matter of, you know, both sides administering justice. One of the prosecutor, one is of the defense, and giving both sides the opportunity to represent either the victim or in some cases the defendant, right? You each have that role. But as a human being, you ever feel morally conflicted? I mean, I've handled many cases, many homicide cases, many child abuse cases, sex crimes cases, that, you know the person did it, yet they're still entitled to, you know, their Miranda, their interrogation and due process. And, you know, the district attorney puts together a case and you work and you build it. And then the defense takes that and you know, builds a case also. But you know from everything you see, this person did it. Do you feel that moral conflict in doing it? And I'm guessing you got to kind of, you know, and you already said it, you have an ethical obligation, but morally, you know, I think it's challenging.
It's not challenging at all. It's a professional and ethical obligation. I can't pick it. I wouldn't be doing this work if I had any kind of moral problem. For example, if I was a corporate attorney representing a huge polluter, you know, would I have any moral problem? No. You're hired. You have an ethical obligation to represent someone to the best of your ability, and you know, your personal opinion cannot enter into the equation. The proof goes where it goes. This goes to the prosecution having the obligation to prove their case. That's all I'm doing, is holding the prosecution to their obligation of proving their case. My personal opinions are kind of irrelevant in that. I don't have any.
No, I mean, it's not really so much an opinion. You don't feel like, I've seen cases where, you know, children were sodomized, raped, you know, and a person it's solely responsible for it, admits to it, and you build a case around it. You do the DNA, you do all of that. And, you know, in a case of DNA, it's that person, right? A six-year-old is sodomized. You have DNA, in fact, it's that person that did it. There's no getting around that. You know that as a prosecutor, and you know that as a defendant, right? A defense attorney. There's got to be something that says this is morally wrong. Like, how am I going to represent this bucket of slime? And I know you have the profession. I get that. But as a human being, does that ever affect you?
Well, if believe it or not, out of all the cases that are prosecuted, a very small percentage end up going to trial. Many majority of cases are pled out, sometimes to lesser charges. And that's another function of the defense attorney, to work out a plea deal that benefits your client and yet satisfies the prosecution. So in that sense, you're mindful of the overwhelming evidence in a situation that you...
But that's a tactic. You're not answering the question as far as morally affecting you as a human being. Are you a dad?
Yes, I am, with two.
Okay, so you know, you have children. You know what that's like. And I'm not beating you up. I don't want you to think that I'm doing that, but you know, it's something I see it with cops. We see what happens. We see investigators. They work really hard on these cases. And you know, there's times that you sit there and you just don't have the case. But when you know you have the case, you sit and you look at these individuals and you say, how could you do this to this child? And they do it. And you go home, you think about it. And it has an impact, but what you're basically saying is it has no impact.
It's not something I can dwell on. I would not be able to do the job if I overwhelm myself with the details of the victims. I'm worried about the evidence and where it leads my client and the case. That's the concern, is where the evidence goes. And then that's part of, you know, it's not a moral issue for me. It's simply, you know, my professional obligation is to put aside my personal feelings, and that's my ethical obligation. And that's the work that even as a prosecutor, you know, flip it around. What if you had as a prosecutor, you have a maybe not such a great case, but you decide that you need to prosecute anyway. Maybe that's not a clear example, but I do. The morality of it is not an issue, because it's the legal responsibility. It's my ethical obligation. That's the moral for me. Yeah. It's my ethical obligation. That's the morality for me. Just like a doctor has an obligation to treat a patient regardless of, you know, whether the patient on the operating table is someone accused of a serious crime or a victim. It's the same thing. You cannot function and do this work if you are worried about the morality of it. I'm not here judging my client. He will be judged by either the jury of his peers or her peers, or by the process, in the sense that there'll be a worked out plea bargain and they'll be judged that way. I'm not in a position to be judging.
When you worked as a prosecutor, did you have feelings for the victim, in a sense, like, you know, a rape victim, the victims of, you know, the family victims of homicide victims, you know, where you just your heart broke for them?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, as a prosecutor, you're in a different set of circumstances where you have immediate access to the victim, the family of the victim. So there is a whole different relationship, and those individuals are potential witnesses. They're helpful with evidence. I mean, that's part of the prosecution. You know, as a prosecutor, you're not only dealing with the victims and their story and their tragedy, but you're also, you know, they're part of your case. So you have a different relationship than as a defense attorney, where you don't have that kind of access to the families. And sometimes you don't even get that information until possibly close to trial, where you would have access to that information.
When you were doing defense, did you work as legal aid or private practice?
I'm in private practice.
Private practice. In dealing with the defendants, I mean, you surely have dealt with some violent defendants, you know, handling a homicide case. Do you ever feel that sense of maybe being unsafe at times around them? You know, long criminal records, knowing that they could be violent. You have them in your office, you're doing interviews, or do they just become like your best friend because their freedom is tied to you?
You have the gamut of personalities. I have been threatened. I have been reluctant to have face-to-face conversations with certain clients, but that doesn't stop me from, you know, doing what I have to do. But yes, it doesn't, put it this way, it's more the exception than the rule. I would say that, you know, most of the time you have you'll have a conversation. I think most of the time I have clients that are very appreciative. I do a lot of court appointed work. So I have clients that are, by and large, very appreciative of the effort and the time that you spend with them. You know, they can't afford an expense of a private attorney in that sense. So I'm able to get along with most of my clients, but I'm not saying that there are occasions where I've been threatened
sure.
or issues like that happen.
Hey, let me just throw something in about the about dealing with these types of clients. When I was in my postgraduate supervision classes for 3 years in order to become a licensed clinical social worker, I spent two nights a week at a facility in Queens where I ran group therapy and individual therapy with probationers, parolees, some guys and women that had just gotten out of jail after 25, 30 years. But probably the most powerful group that I had to deal with twice a week was sex offenders. So many of them were on parole, many of them were accused, but they were all in court mandated sex offender group therapy. None of them really wanted to be there. I could tell that a lot of these people were really vicious, dangerous people, and they put a lot of people around them. They ruined a lot of lives. There's no question about it. But I had to deal with them strictly from a clinical perspective, and it was very hard sometimes for my personal feelings not to get in the way. But over the course of time, I was with a lot of these people for the entire 3 years. You learn to just look at it as a professional obligation. And, you know, there were some nights when I would come out of there, I'd feel beaten up just listening to the stories because most of them were pretty forthcoming. Plus, we had all the court documents. But I really couldn't allow myself the luxury of getting, like, righteous indignation over these people.
So let me ask you this, Bob. You did 20 years in the NYPD.
Yes.
All right. So, and you worked in the detective squad. You handled homicide court, all these cases that we're talking about. And You catch a case, sex offender case, you hunt the person down, you do it by the book, you present it, you put your heart and soul into it, and yet you have empathy for the victim. Correct?
You mean for the perpetrator?
No, for the victim.
Oh, right? Absolutely, sure.
Right, okay. Now, there's been times where you arrest the perpetrator, and you get to know him a bit, and you understand their story, and you say, gee, I didn't catch a break in life. So you feel something, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing this almost 40 years. And, you know, the good guys, you know, the victims and the bad guys are pretty well separated in the arena to which we work. I can tell you about cases from many years ago that, you know, I will remember some of the perpetrators and some of the victims. And I believe I handle every one of them with a professional obligation according to the laws that we're going to do, but you still feel something in the process of it. You do your job.
Right.
And yet you still feel that that's morally wrong. And some of these people should be thrown off a roof, but yet we don't do those things. We're not allowed to do those things. You handle your job, you turn them over to the criminal justice system. The prosecutor is Glenn, they'll prosecute and they provide the justice to it. And you get a little bit of a good feeling from stuff like that. And that's why I was just trying to differentiate, you know, as far as prosecuting goes. And I can imagine, I work special victims, you know, it's a behavioral crime. So these guys don't really change. And, you know, you may catch a few people that made bad decisions and bad upbringing and things led to it. But for the most part, most of these are recidivist people. And that's what I'm kind of looking at. Gwen, you have a reputation for a meticulous handling of cases, preparation, being methodical. To me, that goes to your work ethic. Where was your work ethic developed? I mean, somewhere along the line, we, as kids, we work hard, or instilled in us in our families. You might have been somewhere in the military. How about you? Where did this come from?
I've worked since I was 11 years old. I found, you know, part-time jobs, had small little businesses growing up, car simonizing. So the work ethic has always been there. The meticulousness, I think it's something you are kind of forced to do in the profession that I chose. You cannot be an effective attorney, especially an attorney that does trial work, if you are not meticulous and pay attention to detail, either as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney, as they would say in law school, or as you would hear the mantra throughout, preparation, preparation, preparation. That's the bottom line. And in any case I do, that is the mantra I live by, preparation, whether it's a hard case, an easy case. It's important that both as a prosecutor, that I prepared a prosecution, as a defense attorney, that I give my clients the best opportunity possible, the best due process possible, that make the state prove their case and do what I have to do. But that just goes with years of doing this.
Sure. Right. Nothing more challenging than working either with a really well-prepared DA, or I always liked the challenge of a well-prepared defense attorney, because it just seems that when you have a good case, it's almost like a master game of chess, to get both sides to tell their story. It's fascinating in some ways. Glenn is a native New Yorker. You know, the state of New York changed bail reform. What's your thoughts about the current bail reform system, and would you have made recommendations to change it either way?
Well, I think I was looking at some interesting statistics. Prior to bail reform, New York City Department of Corrections had anywhere from 10 to 11,000 inmates. Post bail reform, I think I saw statistics as of April 2021, there's less than 4,000 inmates. So there's bail reform in its real effect. I think what's happening, you know, my feelings about bail reform, I think you're seeing increases in crime, whether there's a causal relationship between the number of individuals that have been let out. I'm not sure what those statistics are right now, but obviously there's been an effect of bail reform that's maybe negative on the New York City community. But the positive thing is that you're seeing more, all the people that were released under bail reform were considered nonviolent criminals. Who's left it right in Department of Corrections is mostly violent felony offenders, violent people with assault histories, sexual assault histories, even on the misdemeanor level. So what's happening now is this emphasis for the nonviolent criminals of alternatives to incarceration, that maybe this the bail reform comes from this attitude that holding people in jail for nonviolent crimes, sometimes petty crimes, I'm not saying that all of them, that there's all, and even felony nonviolent crimes, that there's this emphasis on alternatives to incarceration, moving people into possibly changing the behavioral patterns. I think that's still an experiment we're still trying to see the numbers, but I think what you saw at bail reform is the tweaking, there was a little bit of a pullback. It's up to the legislature to kind of maybe revisit it, because I think that there's a perception now that crime may be out of control.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. We're seeing a lot of recidivism on violent crimes, and people were just arrested just days ago and they come back out and do it again. And one comes to mind was, you know, a bank robber. I think he did 5 banks within the period of a week. And the discretion from the judges has been taken away. So I think it's having a pretty big impact. Bob, what do you think?
I think there's been a seismic shift in jurisprudence in New York State. And, you know, I think, for example, I don't think possessing possessing a gun on the street, if you don't use it, is considered a violent crime. So these people are being released without bail. But, you know, we know that if somebody's carrying a gun, there's the potential for them to use it. You know, we had the guy that robbed the banks using a note because he used a note instead of a weapon. That was not considered a violent crime. So this, you know, good intentioned legislation, to me, has just been a catastrophic failure on every level. I think it's the biggest failed experiment in the history of American jurisprudence.
Yeah, it's certainly having an impact, at least in New York State. And many of the legislators don't even want to talk about it. They're all finger pointing to the other person to pass the blame, hoping they get out of their term unscathed. But sadly, it's creating a lot of victims. I want to bring up a topic that's been a real sensitive topic nationwide, probably globally, but I haven't been outside this country. Is the Floyd case with Chauvin and Floyd in Minneapolis. You know, the world watched a police officer on top of Floyd. Floyd passed away. It got unbelievable newsworthy attention almost every day of the week. Protests to the point that it had, you know, changed America in many, many ways. As a professional, both prosecutor and defense attorney, do you think that Derek Chauvin had the opportunity for a fair trial?
Well, that's going to be a big issue on appeal. Eric Nelson, Derek Chauvin's attorney, from the get-go, was extremely concerned about the opportunity of Derek receiving a fair trial. They actually did their motion to change venue. That was one of the ways of dealing with it. There were a couple of issues here. They went to trial fairly quickly, and I think partly because the world was watching and there was this pressure. The attorney general in the state of Minnesota, Keith Ellison, took over the case from the local prosecutor. So it became a special prosecutor, hired outside counsel to prosecute this case. In the midst of the incident happened in May of 2020. In the midst of all of this, there were riots and protests, and the city of Minneapolis, there were arsons. One of the precincts in Minneapolis was torched. One of the U.S. post offices was torched. There was so this was the atmosphere that was created for this trial, and one issue was the ability to get a fair trial, and the defense did actually a survey, and they did the media attention, trying to get the judge to change the venue to an outside county outside of Hennepin County, and there were thousands and thousands of between social media and TV and newsprint, there were thousands and thousands of articles and blogs and opinions out there, and this was the this is why this issue is going to be the major issue on the appeal of this case.
So is that a yes? Did he got a fair trial or no?
Well, if I think he, I think it as I think he did not. I don't during the jury selection, there were no one seemed to have been able to form an opinion that they can be fair and impartial. That's the criteria for picking a juror. Everybody knew something about the case. Many people expressed opinions about the case. And then at the end of the day, the defense attorney, Mr. Nelson, was forced to take jurors because you only get a certain number of challenges to jurors, and there were only a certain amount of cause challenges, which cause means that the juror exhibited a clear bias. And then if the judge denies that, you get a certain amount of challenges on picking a jury. In New York, in the type of crime there is, you get a certain number of challenges, and the defense and the prosecution get challenges. And so to answer the question directly, no, he didn't. I don't believe that. I think it's hard to try a case when you have that kind of atmosphere going on. The courthouse was barbed wired. The jury, there was a request to have the jury sequestered during the course of the trial. That was not done. The courthouse itself was barbed wired with fencing. The jurors would have to pass that every day who were picked. This tested the legal system in many fundamental ways, and that's going to be the issue on appeal. I mean, the judge, in a rhetorical response in the Chauvin trial, said, "Where in Minnesota could we get a fair trial?" But that's not really the issue. The issue was the likelihood of all of this attention on the case, the likelihood of it affecting an individual juror. Jurors expressed the fact that they were fearful if there was an acquittal. That was a concern of many jurors because of their fear of possible violence. This is not a way to have a fair trial.
I want to thank you for your insight. Most people would be afraid to offer a professional opinion on that. I'm glad you were able to analyze it in that perspective. Bob, as a former NYPD, we all watched a video. I think it was 8 or 9 minutes. I forget. What do you think Chauvin was thinking throughout that process?
I think that's the million-dollar question, Ed, what he was thinking. I've tried to analyze what he was thinking. I've watched that episode probably 100 times. You know, does he look aloof? Does he look like he's just being mean? Is he standing his ground against this onslaught of witnesses and pointing cameras at him? I can't fathom. I honestly can't figure out what he was thinking. But I wish that he had given us some indication somewhere along the line about what he was thinking. I think that only could have helped him if he was maybe overcome with fear with all these people surrounding him with pointing cameras at him. Maybe he was just overcome with emotion. You know, it looked like he started out trying to help out. And then suddenly things went south really quickly. So I think any type of explanation could have been helpful as long as he didn't say, I knew this person from working with him in a bar. I didn't like him. I thought he was, more dangerous than he was. I would have liked to hear from him. I would have loved to see him stare at a jury and say, I did this for whatever reason. But I know that from a practical sense, from a legal sense, that would have been really, foolish on his part. But if I was on that jury, I would have just wanted to hear some explanation, because I can't figure out what the heck he was thinking.
I think many of us would love to hear what he was thinking. Yeah. Probably his attorney is going to be the one who knows the most, and obviously he's never going to be able to say. But it certainly has intrigued America to the point that it's impacted policing. At least I believe it's impacted policing, and really, Glenn, from a defendant's point of view, I mean, do you see the impact of policing having a negative impact on the justice system itself, or do you think that some of these changes are warranted?
I mean, I think that the movement across the country is police reform, reform in procedures, reform in even in the Chauvin case, reform on the issue of force. I mean, even though there were a lot of seemed to be a lot of procedures in place, as far as police reform, I mean, I think that that's the movement. I think it's an unavoidable approach, whatever that means. Police reform in the sense of more oversight. Do you want a police department that's more micromanaged? It's probably not for me to, outside my area of comment here. But I see that I think this movement is unavoidable as far as police reform, and each community I think is approaching it differently. The big cities, rural communities, each city is even handling it differently. Look at New York City, qualified immunity, things of those nature. You know, is that part of police reform?
You know, let me just bring up one point, something that happened sure. The other night. There's a video that you can see online. It's of a deranged man in Brooklyn, long criminal history, just walking up to a police officer and hitting him in the head with a bottle.
Right.
The man required stitches and staples, the cop required stitches and staples to treat the wound. And the thing that really got to me, and a lot of people might not realize this, a lot of people in the general public, but in the video, you can see the perpetrator running away, and you can see the two cops chasing after him, and they tackle him, and they apprehend him. Would those cops have even been allowed to do that in Chicago, where under the guise of police reform, you can't initiate a foot chase without getting permission from a supervisor? That's how ludicrous and crazy this police reform is getting, in my opinion.
That's a very good point, Bob, because it's, I'm sure that, and I can probably come up with a couple ideas for reform, but I'm sure that, that case itself, where you look at the impact of it, a lot of this is political in nature, that elected officials feel they need to be, on the train to say they did something because they're placating to a crowd to get votes. And I don't think it's helpful to the overall system when it's just blanketly done. I think we're making major changes that maybe just needed some tweaking. Glenn, you're in the criminal justice system in a different aspect of it from where I am. If you could change something in the criminal justice system, the court system, what would you suggest?
There's always going to be the kind of case that I guess is the exception out of the norm. You had a movement in New York City a couple of years ago with, like, for example, stop and frisk, based on sure. on cases that went to court. There were all these edicts. Was that a positive thing? I guess after, you adjust to the court's laws, you adjust. And now I think as Bob mentioned, I think there are communities where you're going too far, where you can't do a chase. It's ludicrous. The worst thing I think you can have for a community is a chilling effect on law enforcement, which I think is what's happening. There's a reluctance to enforce law because you're not sure of how it's going to be handled down the road, or you're going to be blamed for enforcing the law. So, what needs to be done, tweaking here, like you said, tweaking there. I guess that's always happening all the time. There's always there's always something that occurs that you didn't anticipate that you have to react to, and you want to change it. You want to do the right thing at the end of the day.
Sure, you try to make it work better.
And work better.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's why we're always introducing legislation, right? We're changing laws and moving along all the time. The Chauvin case, there was a juror that was fearful of the Black Lives Matter movement, and I believe admitted to be fearful of it. From a defense perspective, that sounds like an appealable type issue to me. I mean, I'm not the attorney. Do you think that that has an impact and possibly warrants a mistrial?
I believe that that particular juror was an alternate, where she went on the news and expressed that, you know, you can kind of construe what she said, that if she had acquitted or if there was an acquittal, she would have been nervous about the after effects, about her safety. So that's a real concern, but she was an alternate. Anytime that there is a juror that made, like there was a juror that apparently went on the news afterwards that may have, the word is that that may have misrepresented his involvement in protests in the city of Minneapolis, his involvement in Black Lives Matter. That could be, that's a real concern. That's a real jury issue. Normally, if a juror misrepresents themselves, doesn't tell the truth, because again, you have to remain fair and impartial, but kind of hides the motivation that they want to, that's automatic reversal. Yes, that is becoming grounds for a reversal.
Wow.
Because the concept is the jury has to be pristine, has to be, this goes to the whole issue of a fair trial, change of venue. How does the jury get affected by the outside world? And will it impact on them to such a degree that they cannot remain fair and impartial, that they come to the jury as jurors with biases or predispositions of guilt? These are the issues that we always have to be concerned about. So, yes, this is going to be a serious issue for appeal, along with the denials of the change of venue. And this goes to your original question about getting a fair trial.
I got a quick follow-up with that, Glenn. There were protests nationwide, cities on the West Coast, in the South, the Southwest, Southeast, Middle America. I mean, would it have been possible for Chauvin to get a fair and impartial trial anywhere in the United States with this type of media coverage and the sensationalism of this case?
It's a fair question. The case couldn't have been moved out of Minnesota. And as I mentioned, I think the judge Cahill at some point asked in a rhetorical way, you know, where in the state of Minnesota can you get a fair trial? But that's a test on the legal system. That's the test of the legal system. The legal system has to accommodate the rights of a particular defendant and can't allow, this is the tension, can't allow these outside influences to affect the verdict here. And this is going to be, this is why this is a serious issue on appeal. You know, could he have received a fair trial? I think it's maybe the passage of time or the sequestering of the jury may have ensured that, so that the jurors during the course of the trial would not have been exposed to the media coverage. Don't forget, there was also that issue about the settlement of $27 million.
Sure, that's right.
The reflection of the verdict, of the jury. So there was that issue. Public officials, the mayor of Minneapolis, they were sending messages out there was all of this publicity. Elected officials were being public about it. So, you know, could you have received a fair trial? I think that the system could have, the judicial system could have taken steps to maybe work harder to ensure a fair trial. Even if
Glenn, had you been the defense attorney in that case, what would have been your response when 2 or 3 days before the verdict, President Biden weighed in with a very inflammatory opinion about that case?
He said he prayed for a verdict, if I recall.
And he's a lawyer.
And he's a lawyer, and you know, the commentary was because he's a private citizen, he had the right to express himself in an opinion. And I believe it was said during the deliberation. So there was other people that said since the jurors were sequestered for deliberation, they didn't hear that. However, with that being said, yes, this goes to the whole notion of public officials weighing in while a trial is ongoing. And personally, I would have moved probably many times for mistrials. And I believe Eric Nelson did that. You know, that's all you can do. You have to pick it. You have to kind of continue the battle and create your record. That we do this at the same time. We're creating a record for appeal. And we're also we're doing our job in defending a defendant on trial. So he got shot down. There were motions. There was a tremendous number of motions made, and that's how you would handle it. You move for a mistrial, create your record, and move on.
Would you have liked to have worked that case?
Yes, I mean it would have been certainly a challenge. Absolutely.
Yeah, I can only imagine between all the video and the public opinion and the investigation that probably went into that case. You know, it is a short period of time when you think of from the point of incident to the trial. Generally, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into a case like that.
Eric Chauvin was arrested on May 29th, the incident of 2020. The incident happened on May 20th of 2020. They go to trial on March 8th of 2021. And I think that for this kind of case, that's an extremely fast trial track. And this is during COVID, you know, if you recall when watching on TV, they were, you know, so we don't even know how the jurors were positioned, the logistics of the actual physical courtroom. But this is during COVID, which is just an added issue that you needed to do. And from what I understand, it was the first recorded trial televised live, simultaneous, simulcast live in the state of Minnesota. And that's another pressure that I guess in New York, you're kind of spoiled because there's no trials that are televised. And in the federal courts, they never televise trials. And that it would be, if you talk about the added pressures of trying a case, to me, that would be a tremendous pressure and a concern to have to try a case under that kind of media and that kind of exposure.
Well, what about the fact that the state of Minnesota brought in all these heavy hitters from private industry? They spent millions and millions on resources, investigatory resources, background resources, studying potential jurors. And the defense had such limited resources. It was like David going up against Goliath.
Yes. Unfortunately, if you were to criticize the criminal justice system, you know, resources mean a lot in our system, and the ability to have access to resources to do a full job. I think, you know, what I don't know what Eric Nelson's budget was, but certainly on resources, the state of Minnesota spared no expense on this case. They did everything they needed to do. From what I understand, there were literally hundreds of potential witnesses. They had the former Solicitor General under President Obama was involved in the case as well, who did many of the legal briefing and the legal arguments. So they spared no expenses. As Bob pointed out, they brought in several attorneys that were from private practice, from larger firms, to help out. And I believe they contributed pro bono. They were in that position. So that is a concern. And, you know, I think that Eric Nelson did a tremendous job with the resources. And if you look at the motions and the paperwork that was generated, the number of motions and post-trial motions and post-verdict motions and pre-trial motions and dealing with the press, the motions to oppose that, it's tremendous that he was able to do this.
Glenn, the world watches this trial. Maybe not everyone, but the world watches the trial, so to speak. There's a conviction. Many, many people are happy. I haven't really met too many people that weren't happy. But when you talk about the idea of an appeal for a mistrial, there's a possibility that that could be overturned. I don't know if it happens or not, but there's that possibility. What that would do is it would take all the people that were happy about the conviction and make them unhappy about the conviction. And if there are people on the other end of it, they'd sit back and they would say, you know, well, there should be. You know, many times we hear, and I'm a firm believer in this, is that, you know, we're a nation of laws, this our justice system, and we need to live with those decisions. And the courts, I find, have a way of fixing things, whether it be through the appellate division or the Supreme Court. In a case like this, if this were to be considered a mistrial and rolled itself back all over again and no conviction, what do you say to the people that had faith in the criminal justice system the first time?
Well, it goes to what we spoke about earlier. I mean, again, you can't, the justice system, the judiciary, cannot concern themselves about what people believe or think or their opinions, their beliefs. You have to go strictly based on the appellate level on matters of law. And if there is a sufficient showing that Derek Chauvin did not receive a fair trial, then that verdict is overturned and they'll retry it if necessary. So that, you know, the outside influences, again, should not affect a judge's decision, just like it shouldn't affect my decision on how to proceed on the case.
In many ways, though, I have to think that it does affect, and I agree with you, it shouldn't, but in a case, let's say this case were to be overturned and, you know, certain processes were not followed, judges indirectly are changing legislation, you know, based on the law, right? They're implementing their view. You know, if the points that we talked about earlier for appeal turn out to be correct and this judge turns out to be wrong, do we question the integrity of those of that judge's decision and wonder if, you know, there was an intent to invoke his will into a case, whether fear of protesters coming to his house for his family, things along those lines? I mean, to me, that sounds like a reasonable possibility.
I mean, I guess anything's possible, but I don't believe that if the judge made an error of law, let's say, for example, in denying a change of venue motion, then that's a legal issue that whether the judge made an error, that's what the appellate courts do. They review the cases for that error. I don't believe that the appeals courts, if there is a true issue for appeal, worries about, it's not a personal reflection on the judge below. It's simply, you know, it's a judgment call. That's what judges do. And sometimes they do make mistakes or they make errors or there's a misunderstanding of a legal issue or an objection that should have been sustained that wasn't. So there's a whole variety of different ways that an appeal comes up, but it doesn't reflect personally on the judge. And I don't believe that the judge, the system, would worry about the personal safety, let's say, for example, of Judge Cahill. I just don't believe that would enter into the equation, if that's what you were asking me.
Well, yes and no, because like you highlighted numerous areas for potential appeals for mistrial, which if your thought process is correct, then that would pretty much say that this judge made numerous errors. And that would beg the question, does he belong on a bench to make that many errors?
I couldn't comment on the judge who tried this case. I don't know much about him because I don't practice in Minnesota. But what I did read is that he's very well respected. And judges aren't perfect. You know, we try to reach perfection in the justice system, but it's far from that.
Sure.
The criteria is, were you given a fair trial, not a perfect trial? And so, you know, if there was a mistake, and for all we know, the appeal may be denied.
Right.
Okay, so it may go to a higher court. So again, it doesn't reflect on the legal acumen of the judge below. If there was an error, judges like and prosecutors and defense attorneys make mistakes, and you know, there's ineffective assistance of counsel issues for defense attorneys. This prosecutorial misconduct for prosecutors, and judges make errors as well. So there's no such thing as a perfect trial, but you try your best to have a fair and impartial proceeding, and you hope for the best. And in this case, you know, it remains to be seen about whether that was accomplished.
Bob, should the appeal be overturned? And you know, from working these protests and being out in the street, it's going to create a hostile nation. How do you address that to the members of law enforcement that, you know, we're enforcing the laws? The court's convicted. We enforce that law. The courts overturn it. We support those decisions. Right? We're a nation of laws, and we have to have faith in the justice system. So what do you say to the people who become irate over this, that begin to burn cities down again? How do, and what would you recommend to the leaders of these cities to say, more importantly?
I think we're, with the hostility in this nation in my 64 years has never been greater. You know, I even observed this as a preteen in the 1960s, because I had socially aware parents. I had a brother at the Vietnam age, so all of this stuff. I was always a history buff. So as I watched history be made in the 60s, I was a keen observer. I was watching the news every day, but the anger and hostility that we're going through today, I think pales in comparison to what was happening back then. And I think it goes way beyond, you know, police issues and law enforcement issues. Our country is at war with each other right now. And it's sad to say, because I really consider myself an optimist. I'm very rarely pessimistic about anything. But I really believe that if the ship doesn't get righted in the next couple of years, and I don't see how that's going to happen with what some of the things that are going on now, that we're really on a rocky slope, and it's not for the better. And I don't know what to tell these people, because we really need to kind of pick ourselves up and just try to rectify a lot of our differences. But there's no work being done in that direction right now by any party, by any organizations. Unfortunately, the police, as throughout history, were looked upon as the most visible villain. As a former police officer, you know, a longtime support, lifelong supporter of law enforcement, I think that's incredibly unfair. But it seems like it's just par for the course. We're the most visible object to throw darts at in times of duress like we're going through now.
Well, if we start getting hit with those darts, we know a good attorney that we could recommend here to help us prosecute them or get us out of a jam if it happens. I'm going to have to wrap this up. Glenn, I want to thank you for taking the time out. Very informative. I'd love to bring you back to talk more about the criminal justice system and, you know, maybe even find ways that we could offer up to fix things. Bob, always a pleasure. Thank you for participating, and thank everyone for watching. I'm Ed Mullins, and this was To The Point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.